Sorry. Hey, wow, this is great. I didn't think anybody had come to this session. I thought it'd just be me and one other guy. So, has everybody enjoyed Tech Ed this week? Yes? Fantastic. Okay. Has everybody got enough of this? You got it? Before the end of the session, take a snap picture, whatever. By the way, I use an iPad, and on my iPad, I have a great app called Flipboard, and I was looking through Flipboard this morning at breakfast, and I thought, huh, that's my slide from the other day. Cool. Very nice. Okay. Well, the nice thing about this session is that if we, by perchance, run over, which I never do, by the way, if we, by perchance, run over, it's a Friday, and, you know, that's fine. We're okay. It's the last session. So, first of all, a very good afternoon to you. Welcome along to part two of the Cryptography Chronicles. It's wonderful to see you all back again. For those of you who I've not met before, then shame on you. My name is Andy Malone. I'm an MVP in enterprise security for 7 years. I'm an MCT in, 17 years now. So I was teaching back in the days of yore, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. You know, we've all kind of been through the mill. I do a little bit of, I do a lot of consulting as well as training, both in infrastructure and security. And somebody said to me, Andy, what's your kind of favorite product at the moment? Which product do you like? I love Office 365. I love it. Okay? So that's the product I really like. As before, both sessions, part one and part two, really constitute 400 level. For the many people who don't know cryptography, it would be a level 400. I would say, though, if you do know cryptography, it's going to be a level 300. Okay? It's quite a difficult topic to kind of gauge. So that said, part one was all the geeky stuff. So if you didn't see part one, then don't worry, because it's actually up on the web now and you can download it. Part two today, we're going to actually talk about cryptography at work. We're going to talk about the pros and cons of cryptography, kind of talk about the different solutions. And as I said yesterday in the theatre session, lunchtime yesterday, a lot of people know about cryptography. The tools are there, BitLocker, SSL, TrueCrypt, and all the different tools. But it's amazing how many people don't actually use them. So we're going to talk about how it actually works. We're going to look at examples of data in transit solutions. So like the other day, I'm going to pick a couple of solutions. I'm going to look at SSL. And I'm going to look at IPsec in a bit more detail. On top of that, I'm also going to talk about data at rest solutions as well. So when we talk about data at rest, we talk about data on a physical hard drive, whether you're using a laptop. It might be any kind of mobile device that you've got. And of course, I'm not just talking about BitLocker. I'm talking about products like TrueCrypt, DataArmor. There's a whole bunch of them out there. Now, we're also going to talk about the controversies of cryptography. So there is an arrogance among the select few of cryptographers that automatically assume that because, they can't break it, that you can't break it either. And it's probably well known that the cryptography of today, within a few years, will probably be broken. The nature of things, computing power gets more powerful, there's new ways to break cryptography, there's new types of cryptographic algorithms coming in. But I also have the greatest respect for these people. These are uber smart people. So we're also going to talk about trust models as well. And again, I'm going to give you different examples of trust models. Remember what I said the other day, this was a journey. It's a journey into cryptography. So we're going to take you kind of from A to Z, looking at the different features, the benefits. So hopefully at the end of today, combined with the other session a couple of days ago, you'll have a nice kind of rounded approach to what cryptography actually is. So that said, we're going to look at trust models. So talk about certificates. and why suddenly they are becoming so much more important than they used to be. Of course, you don't have to have the full certificate infrastructure. So one of the nice, in my opinion, very underutilized technologies is PGP, pretty good privacy. So we're going to talk about that type of certificates as well. And I'm also going to look at things like strengths and weaknesses and so on. So kind of all of these. This is the plan for the next kind of 75 minutes. So when we talk about what is cryptography, well, we covered this the other day, but cryptography is something that you know. So, great, I know the code. So that little thing that I put up at the beginning, I used a code for that. So the code is the most important thing. If you can work out the code, then you'll, you know, get the answer. So the code is everything, often a PIN number, a password. So it's something that you know personally, and often it's a real challenge to keep that password secret. Something that you are, okay? So something that you are, your credentials, so whether it's a Windows Live account, something that you, you know, a particular job. So you, for example, I work for a big company in Edinburgh, one of my big customers, and depending on the type of job that you do will let you into certain areas of their business, okay? So there's different levels. Also something, somewhere you are as well. So if you're using things like GPS technology, I find that a little bit creepy, to be honest, okay? I know that, you know, Facebook, you know, Andy's in, you know, Andy's in Amsterdam in this particular hotel. I find that a little bit creepy. But there are distinct benefits of cryptography, and it's amazing how many people don't use them. So it definitely can keep things secret. You know, we were asked yesterday in the panel discussion, Andy, if I use, you know, to the best of my knowledge, I use all the best tools to ensure absolute security. Am I safe from a hacker? And I would probably say, and I think most of us in this room would agree, if a professional wanted to attack you, there is pretty much nothing you could do. But what you can do is you could make them jump through many, many hoops, hopefully making them go away. But one of the most important things that cryptography does do, and we've really become to rely on this very, very heavily, is it protects our data in transit. So more and more of us, we were talking about BYOD yesterday, we're talking about cloud infrastructures, so more and more of us are attempting doing e-commerce in the cloud, for example, e-banking solutions. They rely on this fabric very, very closely. But it also protects data at rest solutions as well. So again, many of us are walking around with personal devices, PDAs, and so on. Phones, gosh, PDA, that's an old-fashioned word now, isn't it? Very retro. But we're walking around with our pods and pads and Windows phones and devices. So if somebody steals your phone, then at least you know you could do a remote wipe, the data's encrypted, that's fine. Okay, so, you know, you've got insurance, hopefully, to get a new device. But anyway, there are benefits. There are pros and cons, as I've said. Okay, so the controversies of cryptography. Generally, in most cases, if I've got access to the data, there's nothing stopping me. If I found your laptop, for example, and it was, you know, encrypted with BitLocker, I could just wipe it. I could delete the data. So your data's safe. But essentially, that's the big drawback. There's not much to stop me deleting data. As I've mentioned, actually, there is no proof that cryptography actually protects you. There is no absolute 100% proof. Nobody can say, even if you store data in the cloud, you know, no company will give 100% guarantee. Nobody. Even with things like uptime and downtime and, you know, Microsoft, for example, say, you know, they've got a 99.9% uptime. What is that? No company in their right mind would say 100%, because I don't think it exists. They're covering themselves. And I'm not just talking about Microsoft, of course. As I said, it's assumed that if you can't crack it, nobody can. Okay. Another controversy as well, what about the future? Are these algorithms future-proof? Well, DES, of course, they all thought that DES was years ago, and of course that's proven otherwise now. Also, the thing about security in general, it provides a false sense of security. We assume automatically that we're going to be secure, and sometimes it's not quite the case. Government, this is a bit controversial, government control and regulation of cryptography. There's nothing, absolutely nothing to stop you writing your own cryptographic algorithms today. Absolutely nothing. And they're you can make them freely available. But if you want to make them mass available, you need the kind of the frameworks in place where you have to go through certain institutions, certain agencies. NIST, for example. The NSA, for example. National Security Agency in the US. And often, the controversy there is, hey, if you're not going to use my cryptographic algorithm, then we're not going to do business with you. Why is that? Again, quite controversial. Also, in many countries, you know, if you're found, you know, you come into the country, you've got a laptop, and you refuse to decrypt the laptop, or you decrypt the drive, you could be in serious trouble. Okay? Sometimes some countries kind of wrap it under this anti-terrorism law. But actually, it's quite interesting. Out of a, I know somebody in London, Heathrow. And people leave laptops and devices all the time. Here's a question for you. Out of 100 devices that they pick up, how many do you think are encrypted? One, yes. There's generally, that's the number, one in 100 is encrypted. So the vast majority of us, that's a perfect example, vast majority of us don't use encryption. And it's actually quite interesting. And I said to my friend, I said, why don't you, you've got BitLocker, why don't you use it?
It takes too long to do it.
It's inconvenient. That's often the way with security. It's inconvenient, isn't it? Okay. So, on the subject of the National Security Agency, there's a few men in black suits at the back there, by the way. So, right, okay. So, there are essentially three suites that the National Security Agency adopt. And essentially, the reason why they've kind of got a suite of crypto tools is, you know, some people look at the sinister side of it, but some people also look at the quality side of it as well, so that we can obviously have that, you know, confidence. It's all about confidence and trust, isn't it? So first up then is NSA Suite B. NSA Suite B, if you buy a commercial open source product today, in fact, 99% of cryptographic algorithms on the market, certainly in the West anyway, use NSA Suite B. Depending on where you are, of course, in the world, the Chinese have their own suite of algorithms, as does the Russians and so on. Okay? So many countries have their own different cryptographic tools. So things like AES encryption, Diffie-Hellman, which I looked at the other day, are perfect examples of NSA Suite B. And they're pretty good. You know, they actually do go up to top secret standard. Many military and government organizations use these. Again, there are different flavors. AES, the other day, I spoke about 128, 192, 256. The more numbers, the better. NSA Suite C, there's not much known about Suite C at the moment. It's going to be a new suite of generally unclassified cryptographic tools. They're going through a lot of testing at the moment. If you want to know more about that, have a look at the NSA website on cryptographic algorithms and also NIST as well. They give some really good articles on there. So generally, for day-to-day use and up to top secret standard. So very, very useful for both government, military, and most of us. On the other hand, NSA Suite A, of course, is absolutely top secret. So these are used by generally military organizations, highly classified, and you can see there's a reasonably good suite of tools here. Now, of course, in terms of what's the cryptographic spaces, these, you know, they can go up to a lot larger numbers than 2048 and beyond. So we're talking quite big cryptographic key spaces here. So NSA Suite A, of course, will never be released to the general public. And they're constantly evolving this suite of products as well, which is quite interesting. So some examples and uses of cryptographic tools. As I've mentioned, data at rest, data in transit, and also secure authentication, proving who you are. Okay? That's very, very important today, especially doing business on the internet. So obviously data at rest, products, BitLocker, TrueCrypt, the encrypting file system, it wasn't much good in the early days, but now it's actually pretty good. Also, there's a number of physical devices that you can get as well. Okay? So data in transit, EAP TLS, SSL, secure email, secure MIME. Again, there's a number of technologies out there. In terms of authentication, we've got certificates. You've got technologies like Kerberos, of course, which interact heavily with the likes of Active Directory. So there's a whole suite of different tools and cryptographic algorithms that we can use depending on what we're trying to accomplish. And probably the best algorithms will use a combination of each of these tools. So the first of these is data in transit. So data in transit, of course, I'm just going to have a quick drink of my Coke Zero product placement. Okay. Okay, so data in transit solutions. The internet is no longer a toy. Remember a few years ago, it'll never catch on. Yes? The internet has now become a key fabric of society. We depend on the internet. It's absolutely as important as the air we breathe. It's as important as electricity, as gas, and so on. And it should be treated as such. Okay. However, the internet is very vulnerable. Okay. Why do I say that? Because looking back 30, 40 years, there was a base technology. It's a little bit, as I said the other day, with the sewer system in London. Okay. If you're going to London for the Olympic Games, don't worry, it's great, really. Okay. The sewer system in London, it was old, and all they did was keep building on a bad infrastructure. So when that happens, sometime you've got to clear that away and actually rebuild fresh. So I believe that that's really what we're starting to see with the internet and some of those technologies. There's a body of people coming together now, and it's time to kind of readdress those shortfalls. So we're seeing things like IPv6 been released now, and that's great, because IPv6 uses technologies like IPsec built in. Now, is it perfect? Who knows? We'll have to wait and see. But there are multiple threats. Integrity, confidentiality. The case of, you know, I've got a certificate. I'm good. I've got a genuine certificate. But having a genuine certificate doesn't necessarily mean that you're a bad guy. Stuxnet, for example. Okay, so the first of the protocols that I want to look at is secure sockets. Secure sockets has been around a long time. Okay, so whether you want to call it secure sockets layer or TLS, transport layer security, as its more modern name. Currently in version 3X now, so it's been going a little while. It's become the key standard. Of sending data. And the nice thing is it's a fairly transparent system to users. You don't need to do anything. You just need to open up a HTTPS web page and you see that little golden padlock and it's all hunky-dory. It has actually has multiple layers of protocols. Now, to be fair, maybe its one downfall is that it's an application secure. It runs very, very high up at the application layer. So it only, you know, any kind of bad stuff it's going to catch pretty high up. Whereas the likes of IPsec, for example, catches everything. So where does SSL actually fit in? So when we look at the network model, it's actually quite surprising to see it so far up the chain here. And actually, when we talk about SSL, it's actually not just protecting HTTPS, it's also protecting other protocols as well, such as mail and, you know, POP3 and so on. It's amazing, again, how many people don't use this or don't know about it. So, again, it's another hoop for the bad guy to get through. So in terms of the architecture itself, it's actually made up of four protocols. So when you double-click or go in and type in HTTPS, we have a handshake protocol. So the handshake basically says, hang on, you want to initiate a conversation securely. Great. So then, obviously, it then says, okay, what cipher are we going to choose? So which cipher mechanism? So again, I'm connecting to your site. There are a number of ciphers that I could use. Then we have the alert protocol. So if there's a problem with my digital certificate, it will alert me, and I will get an error message. Sometimes in, let's say, for example, Windows Explorer, you might see that horrible red bar, or you'll get an error message. This certificate's not right. Do you wish to continue? Yes. And you just pray and hope that it's okay. Then, of course, we have the record protocol. Okay? Now, next couple of slides show you... I'm not going to go into huge detail. You can read this yourselves later. So as I said, basically alerts the server and the client, lets them know that, hey, we want to do business securely. It also talks about the cryptographic algorithm that they're going to use as well. And it basically creates an SSL record. The alert protocol, as I've said, just lets them know if there are any issues with the digital certificate. Is it out of date? Has it been revoked? Is there a problem with it? And so on. The record protocol, again, this is an example where it uses symmetric encryption. So we spoke the other day about asymmetric encryption and the importance of having the need for both technologies here. It's an additional layer of security. And then, of course, we've got the change cipher protocol as well. So basically, how is all this actually set up? So when you install a server, you install IIS, for example, this installs the server components. So when you install that, you get both a private key, it generates a private key, and also generates a public key as well. Likewise, when you install a web browser, irrespective of what it is, it will also install a private and public key. And part one of this session, we spoke all about private and public keys and how they work. So I'm not really going to go into that again. So this is the kind of the step-by-step procedure on how it works. You know, one of the reasons why I did this and why I did examples of Diffie-Hellman and AES the other day was because we read about this stuff all the time. You know about it. You know, yes, I use AES encryption. What is it? How does it actually work? And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to bring these slides in for you. So you can see here, this is the first step. So this is the negotiation, the handshake, whatever you want to call it. So it essentially negotiates the key, negotiates the cipher, and also the digital hash. That's step one. And then the service actually sends a certificate to the client. So, yep, and of course, it checks that certificate is genuine and that it's okay. Then your computer says, okay, let's start encrypting. Let's start this conversation. So the computer then calculates a master secret code. Okay? It then says, okay, server, let's encrypt. Let's encrypt stuff. And then it says, okay, let's go. So it then sends that to the server. And then the server goes through the change cipher. Remember, the change cipher protocol. That says, okay, I'm going to start sending encrypted messages now. Okay, let's go. Changes the cipher and then sends that across. Okay, so now we've actually got this secure channel between us. So anything that happens between both the server and the client, the evil hacker who's listening in on the wire, in theory, won't be able to things like a denial of service attack, steal our data, and so on. So that's in theory behind it. Now, over the years, earlier versions of SSL have been attacked. And again, there are known exploits to SSL. So the best advice that I can give you is always make sure that you're using the latest browser software, the latest software, make sure that you're using the latest certificates and so on. So let's have a look at this. So having a look at this in action then, just close that for a second. So if I'm just open up a browser to my favorite web page. How does that always get a laugh? Okay. It's my favorite page today. Okay, so I'm going to just, in fact, let me close that down a second. I will open up Fiddler. Now, Fiddler's been used quite a bit at this TechEd. And if you haven't seen it before, I know Paula talks about Fiddler. This is one of her favorite tools, as is, it's one of mine as well. So I'm going to open up a web browser, and you can see here, it's actually just running HTTP. So everything's fine in HTTP here. You can see it's gone to the main page. We can have a look at this in a little bit more detail. So I can see the data. I can see what headers are actually on this. I can go into text view. But you can pretty much see that even in the likes of hex view, it's all HTTP. There is no kind of secure layers here. Sorry, let me zoom in for you. There you go. I'll be friends with Mark Rasinovich and use his tools. Okay. So, the next thing I want to do then is what will I do? I've got an Office 365 account. So I'm going to go to my Office 365. Let's jump back again. Okay. So now this is a little bit more interesting. So we can now see that a tunnel is now being generated, and it's using port 443. So the first thing that we can see is that when we go to, let's say, the text view, aha. Now, let's just go back to that website for a second. So what can we see? Well, first of all, it's green. It's a nice, pretty picture, so it's very eco-friendly green. We can also see that certificate here. We can see the gold padlock. So if we go in and have a look at that certificate, we can actually view it. And you can see this is the issue to login.microsoftonline.com. You can see that it's an SSL certificate. It's valid to and from. So as I mentioned yesterday on one of my sessions, when you issue certificates, you don't want to issue them, you know, indefinitely, or 5 years or 10 years. In my opinion, that's a real security flaw. You want to probably keep that fairly kind of short. So in this case, it's a year. So we can go in, we can have a look at the digital certificate. I'm going to come back to this properly in a minute when we look at certificates. And you can also see where it's come from, the path. So in this case, VeriSign. So I can click OK there. I'm going to go in. I can say, yeah, that's great. I trust Microsoft. So I'm going to go in. I'm going to put in my password. And I'm going to log into my Office 365 account. So, again, having a look through this, what we can see is you can see that, again, that negotiation taking place. So there's a whole bunch of negotiation that those various steps that I just mentioned. And you can see here that this, you can see, is the certificate I'm connecting through the tunnel. Now, I mentioned that, there you go, you can see the version of SSL that I'm using. You can also see it generates that unique session ID as well. The other things that we also have here, it's whether it's using compression, and also you can see the negotiation. So transport layer security, it's using AES 128 encryption, the SHA algorithm, RSA as well. So all of that is viewable. You can go and view by text mode, and also you can see the hex in there as well. And again, you can see, if I scroll down a little bit, you'll see that negotiation taking place. So this is a connect tunnel through which encrypted, it even tells you how friendly. Okay. So that is essentially those steps, very interesting steps, that SSL has taken. Now, going back, of course, it's all down to the strength of the various algorithms that we use. So if you use cryptographically weak algorithms, that's why SSL was broken. So you replace those algorithms with much stronger ones. Okay. So I'm just going to close that down. So, as I say, just a very quick look at SSL, how it thinks, and so on. Okay. Now, I mentioned that SSL actually works up at the kind of application level. So IPsec is a technology that is absolutely fantastic, and in my opinion, it's massively underused. So basically, the difference here is SSL really looks at web-based traffic. IPsec is everything. So it basically encrypts everything. And it's very much a point-to-point type of solution. So it allows you, if you have a head office scenario with a branch office, you can have a secure channel between you. Okay, so in other words, you can secure the two endpoints. And because it's not necessarily just an application, it's actually part of the operating system, which makes it interesting. And you also get physical hardware. You can actually connect to two physical bits of hardware with it as well. This is why it's such a powerful technology. So the downside, of course, is that many of us still use IPv4. And the problem is that IPsec is optional in IPv4. So you think, hey, well, let's implement it. And you can implement it through the Windows firewall and, you know, the group policies and so on. But essentially, you have to do something. The user has to do something. Whereas IPv6, it's on by default. That's why, in my opinion, IPv6 is a good thing. And I believe there's been an IPv6 session here this week, so you may have seen it there. Okay, so where does IPsec fit in? Look at that. Okay, so much, much lower down the food chain here. So the idea is it's the link layer, the network layer, the link layer, it catches all data through here. So this is fantastic. It means that all data going from A to B will be secure. Okay. So, secure endpoints. Great. Okay. Protects, of course, against network-based attacks. You know, so if I'm set outside with Wireshark trying to sniff your network, if I'm using IPsec, I've really got no chance with it. Okay? So everything, all your data, by the way, I never do that. Okay? Things like denial of service, data corruption, data theft, these potentially can be a thing of the past for you. So can I just have a show of hands in the audience? Let's just have a look. How many people use IPsec every day? Just have a look around there behind you. That's less than 10 hands. See what I mean? Yes? That's a perfect example of where we know that we can do it securely. We can have that layers of security. but we don't use it. Why? Maybe it's a little bit hard. It's quite tricky for an end user, a home user, to use that type of... They got to set. It's quite technical. Maybe it needs to be simplified. Maybe it will be. Maybe it's in the next version. Who knows? Okay. Okay, so where we use IPsec, packet filtering. Typically, you'll see this on a firewall. Secure end-to-end traffic, branch server, head office, you know, military use. Military use it quite a bit. LTTP layer 2, transport protocol, remote access solutions, VPN, direct access. There's a perfect technology that uses IPsec. In fact, it requires it. So a little bit about the architecture of IPsec. So you can see basically we have an agent. So the agent is on the client machine here. Now the local or the agent is essentially initiated by a local or a group policy or a firewall setting in the Windows Advanced Firewall settings. Again, you can see we have an IPsec policy. You have a driver, and the driver talks to the internet key exchange. So the IPsec talks to the IKE driver. Yeah. So the Internet Security Association Management Protocol. It's a negotiation. And then, of course, we have the protocol driver and then up through the actual application itself. So in other words, it works a little bit like this. So the client basically checks for an IPsec policy. Do we have a policy, whether it's local or remote? So if we've got if we have a policy, there's an agent that runs the IPsec agent. It says, okay, hey, you want to do things securely. Okay, let me just check. Okay, so from that point, it then says, okay, it assumes all communication from this box or this location wants to be essentially secured. So the policy agent then connects to the driver and then informs the driver, negotiates the level of protection that they need. So the driver says, okay, do we have a security association? Are we aware of each other? So if not, then IKE says, okay, I need to speak to the IKE service, the Internet Key Exchange. Let's get that association sorted out. Now, that can be either a secret key, a digital certificate. It can be a number of things, which you'll see in a minute. And then finally, if we agree on everything, we then have this secure channel. And from that point, all our data is then essentially secure. Okay. Now, in terms of the actual, how do we authenticate? There are a number of options that you can use. So authentication is everything, of course. So we can either use a digital certificate to identify ourselves. At the least level, we could use a pre-shared key, just a simple password. Okay? You can have both. You can have a combination, again, depending on how strong you want this to be. So the differences between them, you can see in terms of authentication, there are two essential protocols that IPsec draws upon. One of them is the authentication header protocol, and the other one is the encapsulated security protocol, or ESP. Definitely go with ESP because you can see that in terms of integrity, fine, but it doesn't really, it's not very good with confidentiality. That's a real issue. Okay. And it also, it's quite old as well. So comparing them, I've mentioned that SSL is essentially an application. Okay. So it sits very, very high up on the food chain. So it only captures specific types of traffic, whereas IPsec does not. And this is a perfect example of the type of attack. So this is kind of a denial of service attack that traditionally would break an SSL kind of connection. However, if an attacker inserts a bogus IPsec packet or a bogus packet, IPsec just says, hang on, this is not what I'm expecting. I wasn't expecting this type of packet, and rejects it. Okay, so putting IPsec to work. Now, I've been a bit lazy here. I went and recorded my demo earlier, so I didn't want to fire up a whole bunch of machines. So if you want this demo, I can give you a copy of it. So, okay, so basically I've opened up one of my favorite tools, Network Monitor. So I'm just going to fire up Network Monitor and start monitoring. Okay, now what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to the Windows Firewall. Of course, you could do this through group policy as well. And I'm going into, I'm creating a security connection. I've got two options here. This is a server-to-server option. So in the top box, I'm basically putting my IP address here. So I'm going to say 192.168, and it's going to be 2.200. And then I'm connecting to my client or my remote address. And in this case, it's 192.168.220. Okay, so, and I'm now saying, okay, what type of authentication do you want? Okay, so I'm just going to pause that for a second. Can I zoom in? Yes. So am I going to say I want to either request or require authentication? Okay? Now, if I was a server, again, depending on the sensitive nature of the server, you know, if it was, for example, an account server, so it contain, or, you know, human resources, HR records. Obviously, if you've got HR managers, they obviously want to connect fairly securely. So you might say to this server, this is a very sensitive server, I want it essentially required connection. Okay, so let's continue. So I'm saying I want a required connection. Okay, so how do we want to connect here? So I can actually say, how am I going to authenticate myself? So you can see I can specify a certificate. I can specify the signing algorithm that I want to use, the certificate type, okay, and also where is that certificate coming from. Now, if you go into advanced, you can also specify a pre-shared key, a password. You can have both as well. And, of course, you can actually configure this all through group policy as well. Okay, so for this, I'm going to actually go ahead and choose the advanced option. Okay, so now I'm going to just click on add, and I'm going to say let's just do a pre-shared key here. You could have multiple options here. I'm just going to keep this simple. So I'm just putting in ABC123. And I'm going next. And then I'm saying, okay, for which profile, public, private, domain, I'm just going to say them all, give it a name, and then just click on finish. So that's it. That's all I need to do from the server side. Now, from the client side, I do the same thing. So again, you can deploy this through group policy. For this demo, I'm just merely going in. This is Windows 7. Again, just going to open up a firewall policy here, just create a very simple rule. And this is a server-to-server rule again. Click on Next. I'm going to add in my IP address, and this time, of course, it's the other way around. I'm adding in 192.168.2.20. And for the remote server, again, 192.168.1.200. Now, the only thing about the pre-shared key, of course, is both sides need to know about it. So, again, the difference this time is I'm saying the client, I could say, is it required or is it negotiable? So again, think about IPsec, is it's potentially negotiable as well. I put in the pre-shared key that we've agreed and click OK. Okay. Again, I'm just going to say yes for all profiles, give it a name. So IPsec and click on finish. Okay, so that's it. We now have the rules set up, and I don't need to kind of reboot that or anything. What I'm going to now do is I'm flipping back to the server, and I'm going to go back into network monitor, and I'm actually going to start monitoring some traffic. So, what I've done previously, I've mapped a network drive to the server, and I've got a folder full of videos, movies, that I'm going to copy. And watch what happens when I click onto the remote network drive. Notice that it takes a moment to connect. That's because it's going through that negotiation. It's going through those various steps that we've just discussed. And it says, okay, you are authenticated. And now I can now go in and paste that in. And you can see those movies are now copying over. So now when I go in here, we can now see that negotiation actually taking place. So if I just... Okay, so you can see the traffic that's coming through. See, Ike, Internet Key Exchange, it's going through that negotiation period. So you can see that it's agreed, it says, yep, we're negotiated, and all traffic is now secured using IPsec. Great, so it works. Okay, now, when you think about it, if you're doing business, many of you, I'm sure, have branch offices and companies that have remote sites. This is so simple and so, so important. Okay? Okay, so, great little tool. Again, network monitor, fabulous. You can do the same, very, very similar demo with the likes of Wireshark as well. So looking at trust models then, there are essentially a number of different trust models that you can use. So essentially digital signatures. Digital signatures have been out a long time. Excuse me. And essentially what they do, they ensure authentication, non-repudiation. So if I send you a message, you need to know that it actually has come from me, and I'm genuine. I'm sure we all receive fake email. Everybody gets it. And, you know, maybe they're pretending to be, you know, I'm from the Royal Bank of Scotland. And how do I know it's you from the Royal Bank of Scotland? Well, if I had a digital signature, a genuine digital signature, you would know that that email genuinely comes from me. Okay. So, digital signatures work a little bit like this. I have a sender and receiver. So the message, you can see, goes through a mathematical process, a algorithm again. We sometimes refer to this as the message digest or the algorithm that we're using. So it might be SHA-2, for example. So it goes through a message digest, encrypts the message, and then it adds the send or checks the sender's private key, sends it across the wire, and then remember the key exchange that we spoke about the other day. So it goes to the receiver, checks the receiver's public key. Are you authorized to open this message? And then it says, yes, you are. And then it decrypts that message. Okay. Now you can see up on the right hand side there, what it also checks for, very importantly, it checks to see if the message has changed. So, again, the hash value. We spoke about hash values the other day. So if that hash value has changed, even by one byte, it says, oh, hang on a minute, this is not genuine. This is, you know, and it's going to reject it. So, again, this is a kind of a good kind of model to go through. Another very commonly used and very, very important, especially in today's e-commerce, is the need to have a good, solid PKI trust model. So digital certificates, who has or who uses their own certificate structure? Oh, quite a few. That's great. Great. Okay. So basically, when you say, okay, I want to be responsible, we want to have our own certificate server. Great. So you have a number of options. Do you want it just to be a standalone type solution, or do you want to be an enterprise solution? You can have both, depending on how complex you want it to be. So an example of a standalone and an enterprise solution would be, let's say you have a website. If I log into the website, I come knocking on the standalone certificate. I'm Joe Bloggs. I'd like to open an account with you. And I put in my regular email address. So that checks the certificate. It goes through and says, okay, I'm going to store your data in a SQL server. But at the same time, if I log in with a corporate ID, the certificate says, ah, this is an internal certificate. It then goes through the firewall, talks to the enterprise CA and says, ah, you are a genuine user. It then checks your credentials and your details are stored in Active Directory. So both, you can use both. So at the very top here, we can see we have a root CA, certificate authority. Depending on the size of your organization, of course, you may have what we call intermediate CAs or subordinates. Okay. And again, these can perform different functions as well. Again, you may have different, they may be in different locations in the world. Okay. So there are different models that you can choose. It would be highly unusual just to deploy a single certificate server, of course, because that is a potential shortfall. If one goes down, then you've lost everything. So the components, generally, we have digital certificates. So as I've said, digital certificates provide identity for both users, computers, and so on. It's highly unlikely that a user or multiple users would use the same certificate. You generally would have a similar one. Now, again, the most common analogy of a certificate is that it's your digital passport. So I go and get my airline ticket, and I've got my ticket, great. But I also need to prove who I am before they're going to let me on the plane. So I need to prove it with that digital certificate. So the registration authorities, who's going to look after your certificate authority or your certificates? Do you need a large infrastructure? Well, not really. If you're going to go and, let's say, go to a product like Office 365, you may decide to go and buy a public certificate from VeriSign or GoDaddy or somebody like that. But again, if you're a very large organization, you maybe want to manage your own. Okay, so the actual digital certificates themselves are based on what we call X509 specifications, and it has a number of fields which I'll mention in a moment. They can be issued, or they need to be issued, by an appropriate certificate authority, whether it's internal or external. Okay, this authority, by the way, is responsible for not just the management of the certificates, but also controlling the structure of the certificates as well. One last thing that they also, very, very importantly, and it's very important to do this, that you actively manage what we call CRLs, certificate revocation lists. So if a user leaves the company, or if an employee changes department, changes roles, it's maybe important to change or update or, you know, give them a new certificate and revoke the old one. That's very important. Okay, you can manage this for with certificate policies, of course. Group policy, very, very easy to do. Again, depending on the type of certificate and the type of work that they're doing. So Active Directory certificates, of course, are deployed through Active Directory certificate services for both users and computers. And again, the nice thing about that, it's great for enterprise customers. But what about public customers? What about general public? Well, as well as using certificates here, you can also use technologies like PGP. So PGP has been out a little while, and it has the same idea as Active Directory Certificate Services. The only difference here is that you build relationships. You have relationships with colleagues or business customers, and you control the certificates. You manage your own certificates. Okay? So again, there's a whole bunch of tools out there that you can get. This is all open source, and I'm going to give you an example of both here. So in here, we can see that we have got... let me just come in here. Okay. So this is my DC1. And you can see that DC1 is running Active Directory Certificate Services here. So I have got my Enterprise PKI. You can see that I'm just running one server for the purpose of this demo. When I obviously install certificate services, it creates a number of main certificates. So having a look at those certificates, you can see it shows me who's deployed that certificate, where it's come from, what it's responsible for. The detail, again, shows you the version of the certificate. Every certificate has a unique serial number, and also you can see there's the signature algorithm as well. Also, you have a hash algorithm, the actual issuer, and very importantly, when it's valid to and from. You can also put in a subject, and of course, because it's coming from an enterprise source, it also can, you have the public key as well. So if you're going to do business, if you're going to have a business relationship with a partner or a customer, it's important that if you are managing your own certificates, to actually give them a copy of their certificate, which they would need to import. So then you can do business. Again, the actual certificate path. In this case, this is just my root certificate here. Okay, so the other things that we also have here, if I go into, in fact, I have it here. This is just an MMC that I've added in. With an enterprise platform like Active Directory, there are many different types of certificates. And to help us manage those, we have certificate templates. So you can see there are code signing certificates, there's a computing certificate, we have certificates for things like the encrypting file system, okay? That's also very important, by the way. If you plan to use something like EFS, BitLocker, it's all very well backing up your keys, but it's also very important to back up your certificates just in case things go horribly wrong. The other things that, again, very important here as well, you can see in the local computer what certificates have been installed. So, you know, if you are my business partner, you've generated a certificate, I would need to install that certificate into one, either it's a personal certificate or if it's a trusted certificate for the entire business. Okay. Right. Okay, in the certificate authority, very important, this is where I can control things like revoked certificates. So any certificates that I've deployed, so if a user has left the company, this is obviously where you want to revoke that certificate, and that will stop him identifying himself or trying to get back into our company. Okay, so that's just a little bit of certificate services. Looking at a public certificate option, this is a little tool called Cryptofane. And it's a free product. So this is a perfect example of PGP. So I'm going to go and I'm going to say, let's say, view. I'm going to view my secret keys. I need to, first of all, create a secret key. So I'm going to... let's say keys. I want to generate a secret key. I'll call this just Andy's key. Need to put in my email address. Uh, and I could just say it's for data crypto. I'm going to put in my passphrase. So just put in a simple password here. Obviously, you wouldn't in reality. Now, again, very like certificate services, one of the things that you do have to choose is the key length. So obviously, the longer the key, the better. Again, you can also put in whether the key is going to expire. So I can specify, you know, by default, it's 1 year. You know, I'm happy with that just now. So off it goes and generates that key for me. Okay, so the key is successfully generated. The other thing that you'll also notice, if I go to public keys, at the same time, you can see it's also generated a public key for me, okay? So now I can actually send that up to a key server, and there are a number of key servers. This one is an academic institution. So once that's now been done, once I've got my keys, that means that I can now send you a copy of my public key, because we can do business together now. So it means that I can open up a copy of my latest book. Oh, sorry, did I mention that? And there you go, you get a quick preview. And you can see at the moment that's not encrypted. So what I want to do is I can right click and I want to choose encrypt and or sign. So I can do both here. I can do a digital signature, and I can also encrypt the document at the same time. So you can see, do you want to encrypt with a shared passphrase? And this is an example of how it's combining both public and private key cryptography. So again, I'm going to say, yep, I'm going to just sign with the secret key. I'm going to go ahead and do it. I need to put in a passphrase here. Okay, and I go off, and there we go. You can now see that that document has now been secured. And that's now secured with AES encryption. Okay, so that's an example of both public and free-to-use software. Okay, so even if you're working at home or you in an academic institution, you don't need to have that big infrastructure in place to get similar levels of security. Okay. Okay, so moving on, let's just have a look. Okay, so what about key management? Well, who's going to look after the keys? Well, we have a number of automated systems. So ANSI here, and also Key Distribution Center, for example, Kerberos uses this. It's an automated way to kind of manage the keys. On the subject of keys as well, there's something called key escrow, which is quite controversial. So, for example, if you encrypt data with, let's say, BitLocker or the encrypting file system, well, as you know, in EFS, an administrator, if you left the company, can basically use key escrow to recover the key and get access to your data. So that's quite controversial. Should they have the right to do that? Now, in many countries, actually, France have actually just banned this type of technology. And many countries are starting to look at key escrow systems. So, you know, it's maybe a good thing for a business, but again, if you're going to use something like this, one of the things you may want to do is you may want to include it in, for example, an acceptable usage policy. Just make sure that users know, you know, if you leave the company, it may be that we can still access the data. And again, depending on the type of company or organization that you are. Okay, so key escrow, it can be potentially quite controversial. Another technology. So we've talked about data in transit. Let's talk about data at rest solutions. So the other day I talked about BitLocker and some of the advantages of BitLocker it has. I mean, the fact that if somebody steals your laptop or your hard drive, at least in theory, you hope that they won't be able to obtain your data. So there are a number of cryptographic solutions available. So these can be physically hardware-based solutions, so you can actually buy SSDs that have got cryptography built into them. They can be software-based as well. So things like, you know, one of the benefits of this is that they're much lower cost, for example. The hardware traditionally is quite expensive, but they're coming down in price. Another type is a file-based solution. So the encrypting file system, for example. Again, it's the only downside of this is it's user-initiated. The user needs to right-click the file, go into Properties Advanced, and click that checkbox to ensure that you're using EFS. Another solution is full disk encryption software. You know, so whether you're using DataArmor, TrueCrypt, BitLocker, you know, they pretty much do a very, very similar kind of technology. So I'm not talking about a particular product here. I'm talking about the general kind of technology. So the solutions, of course, the idea is they generally use symmetric encryption, which we know about now from the other day. So, for example, AES-256. So you can encrypt your physical hardware with AES-256 encryption. Okay, now, the nice thing about symmetric cryptography is it's very, very fast. So in theory, you would be able to rattle through data pretty quick. Again, well-known cryptographic tools are out there. So when we talk about BitLocker, how does BitLocker actually work? Again, this is not a session on BitLocker, but just very easily. So you've got your plain text here at the top. You can see it goes, before it hits AES encryption, it goes through something called a diffuser. So basically messing things up a little bit. It's actually called the elephant diffuser. There's a very, very good white paper on it, by the way, if you want to read up on that. So it goes through this diffuser, finally goes through that whole AES encryption algorithm that we spoke about the other day. Hopefully you'll remember that. Eventually, you'll get your ciphertext here. Okay, oh, the other thing there is the key. You can see the key, 512 bits. Now, the problem with that, or the problem with many DIR solutions, they normally have a fixed key length. And these things are, if you know what to look for, they're quite easy to find. So BitLocker in Windows 7 and 8, of course, you have a number of options to use. And as I keep saying, if you don't have a trusted platform module, you always want to go with the hardware-based solution. So anything other than a trusted platform module, you are potentially vulnerable. I will say that right now, okay? Other than a trusted platform module. I often get the question, Andy, does that mean that there's no way to hack a trusted platform module? Perhaps there is, but you wouldn't have access to it. Let me put it like that. Okay. Okay, so that's the key thing. What was the other thing I was going to mention? Yes. So one big vulnerability, of course, is memory. Okay, hyperfill.sys. That's been around a while, hasn't it? Yes, another perfect example of convenience versus security. Don't we see that all the time? Yes, I want to be secure, but I also want it to be convenient. So you shut your lid, boom, the machine goes to sleep. And you think, okay, that's fine. I'll just power my machine off. That hyperfill.sys file is still there. Okay, so just powering the machine off, you probably, if you work in a sensitive environment, you don't have a TPM module, a trusted platform module, which is a chip on the motherboard, then you probably want to reconsider that, putting sensitive data on that machine. Now, I did the BitLocker demo the other day, so I'm not going to do that today. Another product, I love this product, by the way. I love it. Open source, free. You can use it. I gave a demo the other day of how you can create an encrypted volume with a file, which is really sneaky. And it also provides something called plausible deniability. So you can have a hidden volume within a volume, and you can have different passwords. So when that guy at the airport with those blue rubber gloves stops you, which never happened to me, by the way. when that guy stops you, he says, I want to look at your machine, sir. You go, no problem, officer, there you go. Okay? So, now, as a forensics person, though, obviously I want to know about all those dirty little secrets that you have on your machine. And believe me, I will find them. Okay. So the encrypting file system, of course, based on NTFS, I'm sure you know the history of it. Okay? So if given a choice, if I had BitLocker and EFS, I would use both. Always have multiple solutions. Remember, keep them jumping through those hoops. Yeah? What about the vulnerabilities, though? Vulnerable to brute force attack. Absolutely. Absolutely. Unless you have a TPM module, blah, 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 the data is potentially vulnerable. It's either stored in RAM. You can do a snapshot of RAM, get the FireWire cable thing going. Yeah? You can take a snapshot of RAM. If you don't have RAM, it's okay. I've got the hyperfill.sys file now. Either or, it's fine. Okay. Other forensics tools, then. There's a whole bunch of forensics tools out there, to be honest. By the way, just a word of warning. Don't go back to work and just go up to your boss's machine and go, I'm going to do a forensics analysis of this machine. Yes, you might find that you're working at McDonald's on Friday. Okay. So, basically what these do is they scan either a memory image of a machine, and they're looking for a specific pattern. Remember what I said, those bits, those BitLocker keys, the passwords to TrueCrypt or whatever. And I'm going to demo, actually, my favorite tool. I use this one all the time. So I did TrueCrypt the other day. Remember I did TrueCrypt? Let me just see. Do I have TrueCrypt open? Yes, I do. I just mounted a volume. Where are we? Let's have a look. TrueCrypt, TrueCrypt. Blind as a bat, you know. Ah, there we go. Okay. So I've got some files here, right? So I've taken a memory dump of a machine with a FireWire cable. And at the same time, I've also got a hyperfill.sys file. Can I just say that the demo that I'm about to show you works identically on both? Okay? So if I double-click this volume, which I have mounted here, by the way, and I put my password in, of course, it's not going to let me in, right? So I can't get in there. So what I want to do is I'm going to run my favorite tool. And this is a tool, sorry, not that one. Where are we? Passware Forensic. And as I've mentioned, this will find everything. There's no place to hide here. By the way, did I mention that this is a Russian product? Okay, so again, I'm using the same tool that I did with BitLocker the other day, but today I'm going to have TrueCrypt. I could also pick on FileVault. I could recover Mac passwords. You know, there's nowhere to hide here, boys. So I'm going to go with TrueCrypt. Yeah. Okay, so you can see it says, okay, the encrypted TrueCrypt volume, and then show me the memory image. So there's I've taken a memory image, exactly the same. You can see it's going to it's going to create a file called decrypted.dd, okay? Which is a raw image. So I'm going to go, yeah, that's fine by me. Off it goes. Almost done. Can I just hold questions for a second? Yeah, I'll certainly do a Q&A in a moment, yeah? Because we'll have time. Okay, so you can see it's decrypted. Okay, now if I mount that, it's still going to ask for a password. And I don't know the password. But the password has been removed for it. from it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to use another little utility. This is called OSF Mount, and it allows you, there's a number of utilities like this. This is quite a new one. And this allows you to mount raw images. So I'm going to go ahead and say, yeah, I want to mount this new disk. I'm going to mount this as the image file, and it's going to, you can see that. Image in RAM, you can put it in RAM as well. This is quite clever. And here is my decrypted image. So this is my image. And what this does, it creates a virtual disk. So now, ta-da! Come on, give us a clap. Okay, and just to show you, I can double click here and I can read all the documents in there. And that's from a raw image. Okay, that's pretty cool, isn't it? Yes? Okay, so there is no place to hide. There's no place like home. Okay, I'm going to do a Q&A, all right? I will do a Q&A at the end. So I'll get through the rest of this and then I'll do a Q&A. So what about emerging and future technologies? So cryptography is constantly evolving, constantly moving on. This is interesting. This is something that a friend of mine in the US is working on. It's called theft-resistant cryptography. And the idea is this tip, you know, when I issue a key to you, but you don't use that key for quite some time, that key is essentially in the open. And that key is therefore vulnerable. So the idea, what we have here, is we give you a pre-key kind of example. So this is a pre-key exchange. You don't actually have the key. It's a pre-key sequence. So you only actually get the key when you actually need it, thus reducing the chance of that key being stolen. And so far, it's looking very promising. Another type of cryptography, and I'm not a DNA expert here, so if I gobbledygook this up, then please forgive me. Another very interesting type of cryptography, in theory, it's got great, great potential. This is called DNA cryptography. And it's got some quite frightening overtones, you know? So, for example, I could shake hands with you, and I'm passing on some secret code DNA. You go and shake hands with somebody else. I take a swab of your hand. I can actually get that code. Yes? Very interesting. So now, that's wild, isn't it? Okay. So, DNA, of course, can perform huge calculations, enormous calculations. So potentially, it's actually been proven that it's broken some of today's cryptographic algorithms. Okay? So, but the key is, if it can also break them, then surely it can also create new ones as well, which makes it really interesting. So essentially, the data, or your data, is processed within a cell. Okay, so that cell is then processed in what we call two stages, a series called transcription and translation. So in layman's speak, basically it removes some of the code from the sequence. So it removes the code from the sequence, therefore creating a public key. So the idea is, if I give you that, if you manage to get that data, the key sequences are actually missing. So unless you speak to me, I can give you those key sequences and thus restore that data. So the clever thing about this is one way. It's like Diffie-Hellman. It's a one-way process. Okay? Very, very interesting. Now, again, we're in the very early stages of this, but it looks very, very promising. Okay? So watch out for that. There are some fascinating white papers on this area. Now, if you want to get really wild, let's talk about quantum cryptography. This has been out, in theory, for quite some time. But, of course, quantum cryptography talks about photons of light. But the problem with this technology, in theory, it's unbreakable, okay? In theory. However, it's a little limited because it can't go that far. So we're currently at a limit of about 93 miles, okay? Because anything other than that, the photons start getting mixed up and ones start coming out as zeros and it just basically falls to bits. But if they get over that, 150 kilometers, sorry, we're in Europe. if we get over that, then this has really great potential. And in theory, this type of cryptography is very, very exciting because it's theoretically unbreakable, theoretically. Now, what of all the everything that I've spoken about for the last few days, what have they all got, what have they all got in, what's the word? The same. Thank you. Common. What do they all get in common? Maths, physics, science, DNA. What are they all in common? They all use patterns. Yes? So, patterns. Okay. So, there are two arguments here. You know, when we talk about random, we calculate random from mathematics. Now, there are two sides. The chaos theory, that everything just was thrown out there. And then there's the random theory that actually everything that's been created, everything in the universe falls into patterns. So, thus, if we use, you know, if we create an algorithm and we just throw pattern or just throw random stuff in, then that random stuff, it's using numbers, therefore it's a pattern. Interesting thought, huh? Okay, so, interesting. Did you crack the code? Did anybody crack it? No, that's not the answer. Sorry? No, that's not the answer. Close, but no cigar. Sorry? Heineken? No, okay. Okay, I've got two bottles of, well, beer. If you want real beer, you'd come to Scotland. But as it is, this is all I've got now. Okay, so, I have got a bottle of Netherlands Finest here to the first person that can tell me who invented... or who are considered to be the godfathers of public cryptography? Oh, thank you. Come in. There you go. That's yours. Give him a round of applause. That's nice. Okay. And from a question... I might drink this myself. I might need it in a minute. A question the other day, okay. Which algorithm did AES upgrade from? Who said 3DES? Thank you. Yes, come in, get this. Okay, well done. Give the man a round of applause. Thank you. First of all, do you know what cipher I'm using? I'm using Caesar cipher. But I've been really mean, okay? Because, I'm using a pattern. I am a true geek. Okay, and the reason I'm using... I know you were all thinking Caesar cipher and you... Yeah, but I used 543, 543, 543. That was the code. Okay? I got you! Okay, so, now you're a true geek, all right? Now, just before we go, do we have any questions? Do you want to come and speak to me afterwards if you have questions? Yes? Again, on the track resources here, I put in all the links that you're going to need for those resources. Have you enjoyed TechEd 2012? Yeah. Give yourselves a round of applause. Thank you so much. Give me some feedback. I'm Andy Malone. God bless. Thank you.